Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Welcome to Tales to Terrify, part of the District of Wonders network. Featuring Starship Sofa and Farfetched Fables, everyone has a story in the District of Wonders. Come and find yours.
Good evening, children of the night. I'd like to give a bit of an apology for this and the last handful of episodes. For audio quality. Well, at least my parts. I had attended an event a few weeks ago with my MacBook Air and its charger. After the event, I took home the MacBook Air, but not the charger. As a result, I've been recording in an unfamiliar environment, and it's been giving me an audio quality that I'm not super happy with. You may not have even noticed, and if that's the case, then I'll apologize for drawing your attention to it. It may not be a big deal for you, but one of the things that I'd really like to get this show to the point of is compensating narrators. Tony hasn't given me any indication that this is going to be right around the corner or anything like that, but I'd like to dress for success as much as you can on a podcast and be prepared for that day. Behind the scenes, I've been encouraging the editorial staff to be a bit more picky with narrations. And I've encouraged a couple narrators to consider a few things in regards to the recordings. Personally, I'm, like many of our narrators, not a professional audio engineer or voice actor, just a guy who likes scary stories that fell in love with this podcast a few years ago. As a result of that, I've had to learn as I went, ask advice from people who are professionals, and taken as much constructive criticism as I could find. Because of my misplacement of that power adapter, I'm now reassessing my recording environment because even though this show is ultimately a hobby for me, I'd really like to deliver as quality of a podcast as I can get to your eardrums. In the show notes, I've added links to some help items at transom.org that I found to be enlightening. Yaoi Sha's voice recording in the Home Studio article includes a series of audio recordings that showcase a variety of sound baffling techniques, and Jay Ellison's simply titled The Basics, which does include some items that are interesting but ultimately not valuable to our kind of project. I include all of this because I know that we have quite a few people who both contribute to the show and are listeners who have an interest in how they might sharpen up their own skills or just know how some of what goes into the production of a podcast like this. I think that's all I've got to say about that for now. I'll wrap it up because I'm a bit concerned about my voice. You may know that I work for an organization that educates children. Past week I had one sneeze on me. Full volume of sneeze went onto my body, and as it was happening, I knew at that moment that I was sick. Let's hear some stories, and then I'm going to get to bed. First up, Alexander Renick is an American and Canadian author of category-defying short stories, Publisher Weekly called A Welcome New Addition to the Genre Fiction. She writes and lives in a decrepit urban manor in the historic Sandy Hill neighborhood of Canada's stunning capital, Ottawa. Her study, Redux, was selected for the 2016 Year's Best Hardcore Horror. More information at Alex C. Renick or on Twitter at Alex C. Renick. Links will be in the show notes. Listen with me to Alexandra Renick's Redux.
Winnie raised herself up on one elbow and squinted in the direction of her bedroom doorway. The room was so dark it was like staring at a sheet of solid tar. The sound came again, a whisper of fabric followed by a nearly inaudible intake of breath. She saw a silhouette move, person-sized, person-shaped, a darker patch of darkness, and her still half-asleep brain struggled to make sense of what was happening. She fumbled with the lamp, clicked it on, saw the person standing in the doorway, and though she began to ask, "Peter, is that you?" with all the confusion, the lack of comprehension, the slow lickings of the dawning understanding of danger, her lips barely compressed into the first letter of his name before he raised the gun he held and shot her twice in the center of the chest. Winnie raised herself up on one elbow and squinted in the direction of her bedroom doorway, dislodging the book she'd fallen asleep reading. It slid off the vintage satin coverlet to the floor with a crash. She reached down to rescue the book, to smooth its fresh bent pages and close it properly, when an odd sensation of extra stillness made her pause. She glanced again at the doorway leading to the hall. Had something flickered there in the blackness? She clicked the bedside lamp on and squinted at the pitch-dark rectangle of the open door. "Hello?" she called out, her voice sounding feeble, wobbly. She felt instantly foolish, stupid, embarrassed, even alone with no one to witness her being all squirrely and girly and scared. Shaking her head, she got up to head for the bathroom. She stepped into her slippers, puffy, ridiculous, moon-faced panda slippers, a gift from her mother last Christmas, and grabbed her garish pink and purple chrysanthemum kimono off its hook by the door, shrugging into it more from habit than a need for warmth or modesty in the empty house. As soon as she stepped into the hallway, a hammer smashed into her left temple. With a soft, startled cry, she fell sideways, knocking a framed picture off the wall. Glass crunched and tinkled as she crawled over it. Her head felt hot, but the alarm bells going off in her brain drowned out any immediate sensation of pain. Warm, sticky wetness trickled into her left ear. Her palms trailed red smears on the wall as she pulled herself upright and turned to see her neighbor Peter standing with a bloody hammer in his hand. Weak light spilled from her bedroom, casting his face half in shadow, a weirdly rounded cap perched on his short blonde hair, like a compact bike helmet with a too thin strap running under his chin. There was not an ounce of any emotion she could understand or even recognize as he lifted his arm again to send the hammer crashing down into her skull. Winnie raised herself up on one elbow and squinted in the direction of her bedroom doorway. Had something woken her? She'd been dreaming about her mother. Her mother turning into a goldfish the size of a city bus and swimming down the street, obeying traffic laws with other vehicles half her size. Shit, it must be late. Winnie rolled to the far edge of the bed, a bed too big now that she and Liz had split for good, and grabbed her phone off what used to be Liz's nightstand. 2:22 a.m., a nice solid number, but way too early to wake up. Rustling in the hallway. Not her imagination. Silent, phone in hand, she slithered off the coverlet onto the floor. Her naked skin hardly made a whisper on the vintage satin. She pressed the cold, flat glass face of the phone hard between her breasts, trying to cover any lights it might emit, hoping she could keep it from making inadvertent sounds. She thought she heard breathing in the hallway just outside her bedroom door. Not labored breathing, but tight, irregular, excited, but as though the breather fought to keep it under control. With some wriggling, Winnie managed to squeeze mostly under the bed. It was disgusting under there, grittily colonized with dust creatures the size of kittens. Neither she nor Liz had been vacuum under the bed types. Even in the dark, she could see the lower legs of someone entering the room. The person attached to the legs approached the bed, not seeming particularly stealthful and certainly without the hesitancy Winnie would expect of anyone unaccustomed to navigating her bedroom at night without light. Whoever it was even sidestepped her ridiculous slippers where they lay as they'd fallen when she'd kicked them off going to bed. One humped up onto the other's back as though intending to populate her room with plush moon-faced panda babies. She held her breath as the person stood beside the bed. Her heart beat too fast, slamming against the flat face of her phone, the sound reverberating so loudly she was sure it echoed up into the room, giving her away.
Winnie, where are you?
Winnie's heart skipped its next beat as she recognized the voice. Peter from next door. Why the hell would he be in her room in the middle of the night? Had soft-hearted Liz extended him an open-ended invitation to drop in that she'd neglected to mention? Or maybe Winnie herself had once made some offhand neighborly comment about him being welcome any time. Something no sane person would take so literally? Maybe he was in trouble, hurt or bleeding from some freak kitchen accident, desperate for his only nearby neighbor to drive him to the hospital. A dozen implausible notions scrambled to present themselves as plausible scenarios. To explain away the intense weirdness of a neighbor she barely knew being in her bedroom uninvited after 2 a.m. The fabric of his trousers made a whisking sound as he knelt to peer under the bed. His bland, handsome face was a pale splotch swimming in darkness. His head looked strangely over-rounded. Misshapen, as though he wore a fitted lumpy hat.
There you are, he said. That's a first.
Trapped. Winnie felt trapped, without enough room for her lungs to expand, to breathe the dust-choked air. Cold wood floorboards pressed hard against her naked spine. She felt flushed all over, simultaneous ice and heat. Fear and the flight urge competing, suffocating her, adding to the confusion of what the hell was happening. He reached under the bed as though to drag her out, and she squirmed out the other side, not even enough room to roll, her skin scraping along the dust-gridded floor. It was a relief to stand. The relief hit her like a betrayal, a false promise of improved circumstances. Nothing was improved. Peter straightened to regard her from across the rumpled bed. He stood between Winnie and the door. Her brain raced, sketching a hasty plan. Something to do with leaping onto the bed, launching past him in the darkness, dashing down the hall, running naked out into the night toward the vague safety of a way. She and Peter were the sole residents of this particular cul-de-sac, but the builder had never gotten around to connecting streetlights, so perhaps the cover of darkness would help her. Could she make it to the next cluster of occupied homes, some distance down the main road, naked and barefoot? Buying her very own house had seemed like a dream come true at the time, getting in at the ground floor, so to speak, with a developer desperate to sell units in an unestablished neighborhood at the ass end of town. Then she'd gotten Liz and a small but nice house near enough to the woods that they saw deer in the evenings, more birds than they could count, even a persistent coyote. Leggy and lonesome, and she observed with a tinge of guilt, clearly displaced by the suburban encroachment on his natural habitat. No noisy neighbors to shatter the peace out here. Only one quiet, corporate drone sort of guy, Peter, who kept to himself, rarely spoke, never brought home friends. Mostly he seemed to hole up in his garage and fiddle with expensive tools, inscrutably tinkering on unrecognizable projects like any number of random suburban yuppie-type dudes. Winnie and Liz had tried to create a circle of friendly proximity and always waved, said hello when appropriate, were careful to respect the neat hedgerow dividing their pie-wedge yards, but privately referred to him as Khaki Pants. The windowsill Winnie had backed up against dug into the flesh of her upper thigh. More half-baked plans and thoughts scrambled for attention in her brain. Open window, tear through screen, fall from second story, survive fall. When Peter stepped back and flipped the overhead light switch, blinking against the sharp stab of sudden brightness, Winnie said, "Peter, I don't know what you're doing here, but you have to leave now. I've already called 911. She hadn't. Shit, she hadn't. Everything was happening so fast. She fumbled with her phone. Unlock, unlock! And wildly started thumbing for the keypad. Her vision had adjusted quickly enough that she saw him shrug. "Doesn't matter," he said. "I'll finish up and travel back before they get here. I'd wanted to try this tonight. You know, for strangling." Tangled in the fingers of his left hand was a loop of strong, soft cord, an unmistakable garrote which he crumpled in his fist and shoved in his pocket. "But I always bring a gun just in case." Her lips barely compressed into the first letter of his name before he raised the gun he held and shot her twice in the center of the chest. Flat on her back in the gap between bed and wall, Winnie watched the ceiling turning red, or was something in her eyes? Her chest felt heavy, as though her heart had turned to lead and now weighed her down, pressing her to the hard wood floor. She dimly understood the wet gurgling as herself, sucking breath through the mess of her shredded lungs. All thoughts of rescue, of Liz, of rage, even of fear left Winnie's brain like air from a burst balloon. The sole remaining thing, the one thought burning away all the rest in the final moment, was why.
"Peter, why?"
The words wheezed from her, bubbling and nearly unrecognizable even to her own ears. He walked around the end of the bed to stand over her, to lean down with a look of polite inquiry on his innocuous, unremarkable features.
"To test my chronoflexic resonator."
He tapped the thin plastic shell of the small helmet he wore, laced with braided wires visibly embedded with dozens of old-fashioned computer chips.
"I needed to do something irrevocable. Something, you know, important. Something the world would notice. I had to make sure everything worked before I take it public. That was why, the first time."
The ceiling was all red now. Peter's face, hovering above, was washed in pink. Her chest hurt, but not so bad as it had a few moments earlier. She tried to speak, but the words ended as a ragged cough. She tried again. Again, Peter leaned over to hear her, tilting his head with that same impersonal politeness one might use with an elderly stranger.
"How many?"
Winnie burbled. Warm trails ran from the corners of her mouth.
"How many times?"
Peter smiled. It was the first recognizable emotion to come into his face, reach all the way to his eyes. He nudged the end of the gun gently against her left temple.
"This is number 12,
he said, and pulled the trigger. Winnie raised herself on one elbow and squinted in the direction of her bedroom doorway. Groggy, mind thick with sleep, she reached for her phone lying on what used to be Liz's nightstand. 2:20 a.m. A nice solid number, but way too early to wake up. She'd been dreaming Liz was trying to tell her some urgent thing, trying to wake her, though it wasn't Liz but her mother. And then it wasn't her mother but her eighth-grade French teacher. "Rise and shine, lazy bones," her mother had chimed in that maternal sing-song she'd often used to get Winnie ready for school.
"Attention, mademoiselle,"
Madame Giraud had snapped.
"Wake up, Winnie,"
Liz had shouted.
"Wake the fuck up."
Winnie rolled out of bed, shoved her feet into her slippers. She was awake. She might as well use the bathroom. It was one of her mother's dearest and most firmly held beliefs that the font of all nightmares was a sleeper's need to urinate. With one hand, she grabbed her garish pink and purple chrysanthemum kimono off its hook by the door, shrugging into it more from habit than anything else. She was about to step into the hall when something made her freeze. Not a sound, not a movement. A disturbance in the silence? Winnie pressed back against the wall behind the door and strained to listen to the inky nighttime darkness. Her heart thudded against the flat, square face of the phone she still clutched, now in one fist pressed hard against her chest as she listened to the quiet. The unmistakable sound of someone walking up the stairs, not Liz, who'd moved back east, leaving Winnie heartbroken and 3,000 miles away. Not her mother, whose arthritis these days prevented her from driving, much less tackling even the most forgiving staircase without a fistful of painkillers. No one else came to Winnie's mind as anyone who might have any claim to be in her home in the middle of the night. So when the intruder, taller than she was, a masculine frame, stepped into the open doorway, Winnie slammed the door into him with as much force as she could. The door ricocheted off the collision with his solid body with more force than Winnie had anticipated, slamming her back against the wall. The intruder staggered to his feet and lunged, striking wildly in her direction with something sharp enough to slice the loose fabric off her kimono sleeve at the first pass. The second pass missed her face by an inch, notching her earlobe, and the third bit deep into the flesh of her left forearm, bared of its sleeve, before tugging free. A bellow of rage erupted from deep in Winnie's chest as though it had amassed and been waiting, surprising her, infusing her with unexpected strength as she tackled him. They fell into the hallway, her landing heavily on top. His surprised grunt was enough for her to recognize her neighbor Peter.
"Stop!" he cried. "You'll damage my prototype."
Hot blood rained down from her sliced ear as she raised her right fist and let it fall onto his face. Her injured arm pressed against his throat. Her thumb, sticky slick, slid across the screen of the phone, still clutched in her left hand, activating the torch function. Hard white light flooded his face, blinding them both. In the afterimage snapshot fused to her retinas, she saw why he hadn't dislodged her immediately. He was trying to protect some strange hat he wore, made of plastic and braided wire, twisting to keep her blows from striking it. She ground her injured arm harder against his throat, wishing she'd paid closer attention to that stupid real wrestling reality show Liz liked. Would he really pass out this way? She bellowed again, bearing down, fists tight over the illuminated phone. Red drops and smears looked like fake blood under the harsh mechanical light, like stage blood, like gory theater. Her other fist fell again toward his baffling headwear. He managed to deflect the blow while keeping grip on his blood-stained knife, a wicked dagger-point item she imagined was designed to gut deer, like those for which she and Liz used to leave buckets of water in the yard on hot summer days. The skin over Winnie's knuckles parted as she was forced to make a glancing punch at his jaw rather than in the middle of his face where she'd aimed. The strap holding his helmet snapped. The contraption skittered across the wood floor. With renewed vigor, he threw Winnie off. Her phone went flying from her hand, its blinding light spinning crazily down the hall, throwing shadows, making everything dance in the strobe effect. Peter scrambled to retrieve his helmet. Fueled by an engulfing rage beyond her surface understanding, Winnie lunged after him. Some internal scale tipped inside her, stuttered into being like a flame ignited by flint. Not even the urge to run could overpower her urge to stop him from doing it again. Even as she swiped at him, missed, hooked her fingers in his jacket pocket instead, the query scampered across Winnie's forebrain. Again? Stop him from doing what again? A loud ripping came as Peter's pocket tore free, spilling its contents into her hand. The gun was cold. Winnie had never held a gun, never pointed one. Never wanted to. In the faint electroluminescent wash from the phone down the hall, Winnie struggled to her feet. The metal of the gun was so cold it burned her fingers. She watched Peter retrieve his helmet, clamp it with one hand down over his short blonde hair. Pink hair at his temple, with her blood smeared across. There was nothing in the expression of his face she could recognize.
"How did you know I was coming? Was it the chronometric reverb?"
he said, not to her so much as to himself, musing aloud. Winnie was shaking. She gripped the gun in both fists, pointing it at him, hoping she held it properly, wondering how to retrieve her phone and dial 911 without letting him overpower her, wondering if she could last long enough for help to arrive, without passing out from the pain in her arm, her hand, the side of her head, the dozen other shallow cuts leaking her blood and turning the wood floor sticky. Her teeth chattered so hard it was a struggle to force words out. "What have you done to me?" He glanced up as though startled to see her standing there. He made a dismissive gesture.
There was a small possibility repeated actions would set up a kind of preverberation, a precursive echo, if you like.
His fingers fiddled with the braided wires dangling from his headwear, trying to press them up back under the plastic, twiddling things back into place.
"Don't worry, I'll tinker a little more, find a different chronometral fold to access. I'll adjust the parameters and you won't know a thing next time."
Next time? She recognized something suffuse his expression then. It wasn't guilt exactly, closer to a rueful admission of weakness.
"Unforeseen variable. I didn't know I'd like it so much," he said.
At her blank stare, he added the words her mind filled in, words she'd dismissed in some last-ditch effort to keep any semblance of feeling sane.
"I didn't know I'd like it so much. Killing someone. You. Killing you. Over and over, every way I can think of. Night after night."
The sheepish look on his face shifted to triumph as his fingers found the right wire, shoved the right chip back into its slot. The contraption on his head flickered, humming with power, coming alive. Two blue lights blinked at Winnie like two mischievous eyes, sparkling and mirthful. "Next time," they seemed to promise. "See you next time." He surprised her, leaping, slamming into her chest so the gun was crushed between them. She'd forgotten the red slick knife still in the grip of his offhand, the hand not clamped over the crazy helmet. She felt the blade where he held it to her ribs, pushing aside the open kimono, but her attention kept riveted on the mocking blue lights blinking, turning his pinkened hair purple as they made ready to engage at his command. "Next time," they winked at Winnie, "next time." As his blade parted the flesh between her ribs, she twisted. Her arm sprang free of their slick and awkward embrace, the arm with the hand holding the gun. His knife pressed deeper. Winnie's skin parted like ripe cheese. The helmet lights blinked faster. Peter began to feel less substantial in her grip. In a moment, she would be dead with his knife in her heart, and he, if she understood him, if she believed him, would be gone. The lights would win, would see her next time. Reverberation from the gunshot tore through her injured arm. The knife slipped from her chest with a sickening glide, then thudded onto the bloody floor with a wet plop. Peter sagged against her, thickening, growing heavier and more substantial as he fell. Winnie staggered backward under his weight, aiming at the winking lights again, firing again. She had to silence those mocking blue lights for good, disable them and never let them return. That Peter's head happened to be underneath them was, it felt in the moment, of only distant concern. She let his body slide to the floor. Gripping the gun in numb hands, she fired another shot into the sputtering blue lights, then dropped to her knees and smashed them with the bloody butt of the pistol, again and again, until she was absolutely sure she wouldn't have to do this again next time.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at UH1.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
That was Alexandra Renick's Redux, originally published in Flame Tree Press Gothic Fantasy Volume Murder Mayhem, as read by Nicole Doolin. Nicole is a writer and voice actor. She performs for a number of popular and award-winning podcasts, such as the No Sleep podcast, Far-Fetched Fables, and right here at Tales to Terrify. To learn more about Nicole, visit her website at NicoleDoolin.com. Thank you as always, Nicole. And our second author of the night, I'm going to bet you've heard of. Howard Phillips Lovecraft was born in 1890 in Providence, Rhode Island, where he spent most of his life. He achieved posthumous fame through his influential works of horror fiction. He was virtually unknown and published only in pulp magazines before his death, but he is now regarded as one of the most significant 20th century authors in his genre. Among his most celebrated tales are The Call of Cthulhu and The Shadow over Innsmouth, both canonical to the Cthulhu mythos. Lovecraft was never able to support himself from earnings as author and editor. He saw commercial success increasingly elude him, partially because he lacked the confidence and drive to promote himself. He subsisted in progressively strained circumstances in his last years, and died in poverty in 1937 at the age of 46. Influenced by the fantasy writer Lord Dunsany, this tale was a personal favorite of Lovecraft's and has remained popular since his death. Considered one of the best short stories of Lovecraft's early period, aspects of The Cats of Ulthar would be referenced again in the author's works The Other Gods and The Dream Quest of Unknown Kadath. And now, H.P. Lovecraft's The Cats of Ulthar.
It is said that in Ulthar, which lies beyond the river Skye, no man may kill a cat. And this I can verily believe, as I gaze upon him who sitteth purring before the fire. For the cat is cryptic, and close to strange things which men cannot see. He is the soul of ancient Egyptus, and bearer of tales from forgotten cities in Meroe and Ophir. He is the kin of the jungle's lords, and heir to the secrets of hoary and sinister Africa. The Sphinx is his cousin, and he speaks her language. But he is more ancient than the Sphinx, and remembers that which she hath forgotten. In Ulthar, before ever the burgesses forbade the killing of cats, there dwelt an old cotter and his wife, who delighted to trap and slay the cats of their neighbours. Why they did this, I know not, save that many hate the voice of the cat in the night, and take it ill that cats should run stealthily about yards and gardens at twilight. But whatever the reason, this old man and woman took pleasure in trapping and slaying every cat which came near to their hovel. And from some of the sounds heard after dark, many villagers fancied that the manner of slaying was exceedingly peculiar. But the villagers did not discuss such things with the old man and his wife. Because of the habitual expression on the withered faces of the two, and because their cottage was so small and so darkly hidden under spreading oaks at the back of a neglected yard. In truth, much as the owners of cats hated these odd folk, they feared them more. And instead of berating them as brutal assassins, merely took care that no cherished pet or mouser should stray towards the remote hovel under the dark trees. When, through some unavoidable oversight, a cat was missed and sounds heard after dark, the loser would lament impotently or console himself by thanking fate that it was not one of his children who had thus vanished. For the people of Ulthar were simple and knew not whence it is all cats first came. One day, a caravan of strange wanderers from the south entered the narrow cobbled streets of Ulthar. Dark wanderers they were, and unlike the other roving folk who passed through the village twice every year. In the marketplace, they told fortunes for silver and bought gay beads from the merchants. What was the land of these wanderers? None could tell. But it was seen that they were given to strange prayers, and that they painted on the sides of their wagons strange figures with human bodies and the heads of cats, hawks, rams and lions. And the leader of the caravan wore a headdress with two horns and a curious disc betwixt the horns. There was, in this singular caravan, a little boy with no father or mother, but only a tiny black kitten to cherish. The plague had not been kind to him, yet had left him this small furry thing to mitigate his sorrow. And when one is very young, one can find great relief in the lively antics of a black kitten. So the boy, whom the dark people called Minas, smiled more often than he wept, as he sat playing with his graceful kitten on the steps of an oddly painted wagon. On the third morning of the wanderer's stay in Ulthar, Minas could not find his kitten. And as he sobbed aloud in the marketplace, certain villagers told him of the old man and his wife, and of sounds heard in the night. And when he heard these things, his sobbing gave place to meditation, and finally to prayer. He stretched out his arms towards the sun, and prayed in a tongue no villager could understand. Though, indeed, the villagers did not try very hard to understand, since their attention was mostly taken up by the sky and the odd shapes the clouds were assuming. It was very peculiar. But as the little boy uttered his petition, there seemed to form overhead the shadowy, nebulous figures of exotic things, of hybrid creatures crowned with horned, flanked discs. Nature is full of such illusions to impress the imaginative. That night, the wanderers left Ulthar and were never seen again, and the householders were troubled when they noticed that in all the village there was not a cat to be found. From each hearth, the familiar cat had vanished. Cats large and small, black, grey, striped, yellow and white. Old Crannon, the burgomaster, swore that the dark folk had taken the cats away in revenge for the killing of Minas's kitten, and cursed the caravan and the little boy. But Nith, the lean notary, declared that the old cotter and his wife were more likely persons to suspect. For their hatred of cats was notorious and increasingly bold. Still, no one durst complain to the sinister couple, even when little Atal, the innkeeper's son, vowed that he had at twilight seen all the cats of Ulfar in that accursed yard under the trees, pacing very slowly and solemnly in a circle around the cottage, two abreast, as if in performance of some unheard-of rite of beasts. The villagers did not know how much to believe from so small a boy, and though they feared that the evil pair had charmed the cats to their death, they preferred not to chide the old cotter till they met him outside his dark and repellent yard. So Ulfar went to sleep in vain anger, and when the people awaked at dawn, behold, every cat was back at his accustomed hearth, large and small, black, grey, striped, yellow and white. None was missing. Very sleek and fat did the cats appear, and sonorous with purring content. The citizens talked with one another of the affair, and marvelled not a little. Old Crannan again insisted that it was the dark folk who had taken them, since cats did not return alive from the cottage of the ancient man and his wife. But all agreed on one thing, that the refusal of all the cats to eat their portion of meat or drink their saucers of milk was exceedingly curious. And for 2 whole days, the sleek, lazy cats of Ulfar would touch no food, but only doze by the fire or in the sun. It was fully a week before the villagers noticed that no lights were appearing at dusk in the windows of the cottage under the trees. Then the lean Nith remarked that no one had seen the old man or his wife since the night the cats were away. In another week, the burgomaster decided to overcome his fears and call at the strangely silent dwelling as a matter of duty, though in doing so he was careful to take with him Shang, the blacksmith, and Thul, the cutter of stone, as witnesses. And when they had broken down the frail door, they found only this: 2 cleanly picked human skeletons on the earthen floor, and a number of singular beetles crawling in the shadowy corners. There was subsequently much talk among the burgesses of Uthar. Zath, the coroner, disputed at length with Nith, the lean notary, and Crannan and Shang and Thul were overwhelmed with questions. Even little Atal, the innkeeper's son, was closely questioned and given a sweetmeat as a reward. They talked of the old cotter and his wife, of the caravan of dark wanderers, of small Minas and his black kitten, of the prayer of Minas and of the sky during that prayer, of the doings of the cats on the night the caravan left, and of what was later found in the cottage, under the dark trees, in the repellent yard. And in the end, the burgesses passed that remarkable law, which is told of by traders in Hatheg and discussed by travellers in Nir, namely, that in Ulfar no man may kill a cat.
That was H.P. Lovecraft's The Cats of Ulthar, first published in the literary journal Tryout, November 1920, as read by Margaret Essex from Australia. Thank you, Margaret. That'll be our show for the evening, Children of the Night. Visit our Patreon page in the links below, and don't forget to like us on Apple Podcasts. Our show was produced by our editor Scott Silk and associate editors Seth Williams and Drew Sebastini. Website designed by Josh Lightsey and theme music by Diane Severson. Tales to Terrify is distributed under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives 4.0 license. Join us again next week for another episode of Tales to Terrify.
This presentation has been brought to you by the District of Wonders Network, dedicated to podcasting the finest genre fiction. You can learn more about the District of Wonders and their many literary productions at their website, www.districtofwonders.com. Thank you for listening.
Would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.